Anatomy and Physiology, the Nervous System, Part 1. As always, on almost all my PowerPoints, to stay organized for both me and you, I'd like to start with the big picture. So once again, I'm going to start with sort of a major function slide and then a major part slide, and then we'll break it down from there. So here we go. Very simply, what are the three major functions of the nervous system? Number one, we're going to sense something. We're going to feel it or hear it, or we're going to smell it or see it. So function number one, sensory. Then comes function number two, integrative. I like that term, integrative, because integrate, to me, kind of sounds like interpret. And sure enough, the integrative function is the interpretation function. This is the processing. This is the complicated part of what our nervous system does. So function number two, processing or integration. And then finally, function number three. After the sensory information is delivered to your brain and your brain processes it, usually it's going to make some kind of response, and that response is generally going to come in the form of a motor signal, which is function number three in general of the nervous system, motor function. That leads us to the basic parts of the nervous system, only two major parts of the nervous system. The central nervous system, typically abbreviated in real life and on the tests as CNS, includes two things and two things only that you have to know stone cold: the brain and the spinal cord. Everything else in the nervous system, therefore, must fit into the category called the peripheral nervous system, or the PNS. That is all the nervous tissue outside the central nervous system, which will include things such as 12 pairs of cranial nerves that we'll study in great detail, and 31 pairs of spinal nerves. And I know cranial nerves and spinal nerves, those words kind of sound brainy and spiny. But if it ain't the brain and it ain't the cord, it has to be peripheral nervous system. So don't let those terms, don't trick yourself on the test when you see those terms. So how's it all kind of go together then? It goes like this. The peripheral nervous system, all these nerves, all these wires, are going to bring sensory information up into the central nervous system, up into the spinal cord, and especially up into the brain where it's processed. That's where the integration takes place. And then usually out comes the motor signal through the wires, through the nerves in the peripheral nervous system, that will carry those motor responses to the place we get the effect that some rocket scientists call the effector. So there you go. Nervous system is easy. Three major functions, two major parts. I know you'd like to call it a day right there, but we're A&P too, so we've got to go into more detail than that. So let's go ahead and bust this thing down. And let's start with, here's a picture that kind of summarizes what we just said. The central nervous system is the brain, so the melon and the spinal cord, all these yellow wires, nerves hanging off of it, even though they might sound brainy or spinally. Everything outside the brain and the cord is peripheral nervous system. So, we got to know some more details. And for your studying pleasure, the peripheral nervous system has been further subdivided into three: the somatic, the enteric, and the autonomic nervous systems. Let's start with the somatic nervous system, typically abbreviated SNS. Let your root words help you here. Soma. Soma means body. And this is the nervous system that, well, it controls our major body parts. In other words, It moves our skeletal muscle. What about the enteric nervous system, typically abbreviated ENS? Well, if you know your root words, enteric, like gastroenteritis or gastroenterologist. Entero, well, in layman's terms, it means your guts. And sure enough, the ENS, if you're ever asked, is the brain of the gut. The third division of the peripheral nervous system is the autonomic nervous system, or the ANS. And it controls three things that you've got to know stone cold. These three things just need to be able to roll off the tip of your tongue. The ANS controls smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. The way I remember it is, autonomic kind of sounds like automatic. And all those three things are kind of on cruise control. I mean, we're not sitting here thinking, oh, I think I need some bile. I'm just going to squish my gallbladder and get some juice out of it. That's not the way it works. So those things are under cruise control. They're automatic. Then, for our studying pleasure, the autonomic nervous system has been further subdivided into two divisions, the sympathetic division and the parasympathetic division. We'll study these in more detail when we get to the autonomic nervous system PowerPoint, but a little intro here is good. The sympathetic division, it controls what are called fight or flight activities. How this got its name was kind of like this. In the old days, if someone ran into a bear in the woods, they had to make a decision. Are they going to fight or are they going to run? And basically, all the things that are happening in your body at that time, they're under the control of the sympathetic division. But I want to move this up to more modern times. I'll give you a better example that we could probably all relate to. Think of the last time you were almost creamed in the intersection by someone running the red light. All those things that were happening in your body at that time. You started breathing deeper. Your heart started beating faster. You probably turned white as a ghost. You started sweating. Your pupils were probably widely dilated. All those things that were happening at that instant were under the control of the sympathetic division. So you can kind of think of it like the scared division. Next comes the parasympathetic division. It controls rest and digest activities. That's a good term for this. The way I think about it is when I think of the parasympathetic division and I see the letter P there, when I see that, I think of a couch potato, P for couch potato. And my visual I'll give you now will be one that will help you remember the functions of the parasympathetic division, I hope, for a long time. Think of couch potato man. So here's a guy laying on the couch. And you gotta imagine he's watching a movie. It can't be an action movie. It has to be like a tearjerker kind of movie, kind of a chick flick kind of a movie. And he's eating some pizza and he's drinking some Pepsi and he's crying during the movie because it's one of those tearjerker kind of movies. So all of the things that are happening in that person's body, when he's eating and drinking and digesting and probably having to urinate and defecate, all the things that are happening in that couch potato man is under the control of the parasympathetic division. So they're opposites, aren't they? The sympathetic is the scared division. The parasympathetic is the ain't scared division, kind of like a sticker I used to see on the back of some of the windshields of the cars in the parking lots. And they work together. Most organs have a balance of these two divisions in play at any given time. One's the fast and one's the slow. One's the up, one's the down. One's the high, one's the low. One's the yin, one's the yang, whatever that means. But you get the point. This next slide is sort of a summary slide. There's really no new information here. I'll just give you a few examples maybe while you're writing some notes down of some of the things I was just saying. But here we have, over to your left, we have the three divisions of the peripheral nervous system. And it doesn't matter which division we talk about. Each division is going to have a sensory part. Then we're going to have a processing, or the part we call integration. And then we have a part called the motor part, which will have an effect at the place we call the effector. So let's give examples for each one. First, the somatic nervous system. Let's say I put my hand on a red hot burner on the stove. Well, there's sensory information sent to my brain, and those heat signals are sent to my brain. My brain says, well, that's really hot, and I don't feel like melting my hand into the burner today, and I'm the brain, and I'm real smart, so I'm going to send out a signal through some motor nerves to the place we get the effect, in this case, which would be the skeletal muscle in my arm, and I'm going to pull my arm off the burner. For the autonomic nervous system, let me give again the example of the accident you almost got into in the intersection. There's a lot of sensory input going in at that time, you could imagine. That sensory input that you're hearing and seeing, that's going to the brain, and the brain sends out motor signals, and those motor signals go to the place we get the effect. In this case, your heart starts beating faster, you start sweating, and so forth. Lastly, here we have the enteric nervous system. Remember, that's the brain of the gut. Let's say you have a double whopper lodged in your colon, and your colon's all stretched out. Sensory signals are going to go maybe to the brain, and the brain's going to say, oh, I feel stuffed. I think I'll do something about that. I'll send out some motor signals, which will go to the smooth muscle in my intestines and squish out the cheeseburger. One thing I want you to notice on this slide. Notice there's a blue arrow that goes directly from the sensory part of the brain of the gut to the motor part of the brain of the gut. Somebody who had nothing better to do did some ultra-fine dissection one day and found that there was a separate network of neurons in the guts that didn't have to communicate with the brain and could kind of operate on its own. And that's why they broke out the enteric nervous system separately. When I went to school, we didn't know that, and we didn't do this. When I went to school, we really lumped all that stuff in the autonomic nervous system. Those of you paying attention were probably already thinking, now, wait a minute, all that stuff in the guts, you know, the smooth muscle and the glands, isn't that under control of autonomic? Well, yeah, they work together. So the ANS and the ENS do work together. I wish they were still just all lumped together in the ANS. But again, since we learned more since I went to school, we have to know that there's a brain of the gut. Let's go ahead now and change gears. We're going to do a little bit of microscopic anatomy, stuff that's overlapped very well with lab. So here we go. Let's talk about the main cell types in the nervous tissue. The main one is called a neuron. A neuron equals a nerve cell. They mean exactly the same thing. They are synonyms. They are the main functional cell types in the nervous tissue. It is the workhorse of the system, so to speak. The thing that is special that a neuron can do is that it can conduct electricity. It can conduct impulses. What you need to write down here, though, is the nerve cells, at least for the purposes of our course, cannot divide and multiply. Let's now look at the second major group of cells in our nervous tissue called neuroglial cells. That word, if you break it down, if you like your root words, means nerve glue. When I went to school many years ago, we just thought these cells just kind of stuck it all together. Let me use the visuals here, too. Over to your left, big drawing of a neuron that you're going to study in detail in the lab. Down below here in purple is a histological preparation showing this big kind of purple octopus-like looking cell. That's the neuron. And notice it's surrounded by many tinier cells. These outnumber the neurons, you know, maybe 50 to 1. So they're large in number and small in size. And again, when I went to school, we just thought it kind of stuck it all together. But we learned a lot more since I went to school. And these cells, we will see there are six different types of them that have six different names and six different functions. And we'll talk about all of them today. In general, they protect, they nourish, they take care of the big mommy and big daddy neurons. Now, they cannot conduct impulses, but they can do something neurons can't do. They can divide and multiply. So what? Well, I could ask you a really great clinical application question about this. And you have to know a little bit about tumors and cancers to be able to answer the question. A cancer usually starts with one cell going bad. Something happens to its genetic machinery and it starts to kind of grow haywire into a mound of cells we call a tumor. So, knowing that, if on the test I ask you what type of cell usually forms brain tumors, what would you say? Neuron? Or neuroglial cells. I hope you would say neuroglial cells because those are the ones that can divide and multiply and can grow into tumors. You may have even heard the term glioma. Oma means tumor and glial refers to it's a tumor of neuroglial cells, and gliomas are not uncommon types of brain tumors. We need to break down the parts of the neuron. So here we go, the main body of the cell that contains the cytoplasm and the nucleus is called the cell body. In lab, I think you may have learned a synonym for that. It's called the perikaryon, but I just call it the cell body because that's easier. One important big picture point here is I want to talk about the color of those cell bodies, because we're going to talk about and have talked about gray matter. Why is gray matter in our nervous system gray? In real life, if we do an autopsy or surgery on a brain or on a spinal cord and you see tissue that looks gray, why does gray matter look gray? Because in gray matter, you have cell bodies of neurons, and those cell bodies are packed with rough endoplasmic reticulum, and that's what makes gray matter look gray. There is a name for those rough ERs found in the neurons. They're called NISSL bodies, N-I-S-S-L. You may hear that term. Next on the neuron, as you see here, there's a bunch of small branches or nerve fibers that extend from the cell body. These branches, we'll see when we study neurophysiology, they conduct electricity or electrical signals toward the cell body. They bring that information sort of into the brain of the cell, and they are called dendrites. On most neurons, there is usually one and only one big yellow high tension, high voltage electrical wire. This is a nerve fiber that conducts electricity or impulses away from the cell body, kind of like a lightning bolt traveling down a wire. And this process is called an axon. An axon is where the action is. It carries a high tension, high voltage electrical spike down that wire to wherever it's going next. More definitions. There is a little cone-shaped piece here extending from the cell body called the axon hillock. Hillock just means little hill. I like to think of this like a connector piece, so to speak. I think of the axon as a high tension wire, and then I gotta plug it into the body, and then you have to have this connector piece to kind of plug it in there. And that's the axon hillock. The initial segment is simply the name given to the first piece of the axon as it comes out of the axon hillock. Initial segment just means the first piece. Finally, on this slide, the trigger zone. This is going to be important when you're going to be studying neurophysiology. The trigger zone is where the action potential starts. That's where the lightning bolt starts from. You should make a little arrow right here from the trigger zone and draw up to here and circle around these two bullet points, because if I ask you, the trigger zone is located where the axon hillock meets the initial segment. If we trace the axon down to its endings, it gets what I like to think of as split ends. If you've ever seen split ends of a hair, that's a good analogy for you. But these split ends have a name. They're called axon terminals because they're at the end of the axon. Then at the very tips of those split ends are these tiny little bulbous structures that are called synaptic end bulbs, because they're shaped like bulbs and they're at the end of a connection that we're going to study called a synapse. Inside those end bulbs are vesicles, little packets that contain substances in general that are called neurotransmitters. Last but not least, please don't forget that a neuron is a nerve cell. A cell is a cell with all the parts you learned pretty much in A&P1. And I know this sounds simple, but what surrounds a cell? A cell membrane. And it's easy when you're thinking of this like a small round cell from A&P1. But what you have to realize here is this is the funkiest shaped cell in the human body. They're the longest cells in the human body. What a weird shape it has. As weird as it is, what you have to picture in your mind's eye, and maybe follow my arrow, is that this cell, including the dendrites and the cell body and the axon and the axon terminals and end bulbs are all surrounded by a cell membrane. A really funky shaped cell membrane because it's a really funky shaped cell. Why am I stressing the cell membrane when it seems so simple? Because when you're studying neurophysiology, which is tough stuff, if you don't understand this concept, you won't be able to understand neurophysiology because electrical signals are going to be traveling along and through that cell membrane. This is a great place to introduce something called myelination. Notice, I finished talking about the parts of the cell, so now we're talking about something that's not part of the nerve cell proper. Myelin is a whitish, fatty sheath around most axons. I think your book says about 80% of human axons have myelin. In ANP1 lab, you should have seen this when you dissected the hamstrings and you saw the big white nerve back there, the sciatic nerve, the largest nerve in the human body, that looked kind of white and shiny, and the reason is because it was surrounded by fatty white myelin. Notice it surrounds the cell membrane of the axon. In other words, these little jelly rolls of fat are on top of, on the outside of, the cell membrane. They're not part of the cell. The purpose is to insulate and increase speed of conduction along the high tension wire we call the axon. Unbelievable to think this, but speeds of up to 300 miles an hour can be achieved down a myelinated axon. And it's really important, and I'll give some examples to bring this down to earth, some clinical examples. There's a disorder called multiple sclerosis, or MS. And in MS, our killer T cells make a mistake. And what they do is they kill off the myelin off of our wires. If you strip the insulation off of wires, what happens to those wires if you sort of touch them together? Well, you get a short circuit, and that's exactly what happens in MS. Wherever their nervous tissue gets attacked, they get a short circuit. So they might not be able to walk or to talk or to go to the bathroom. It depends where the MS attacks. Just for interest's sake, I want to talk about when the body completes myelination, because this is just fascinating to me. I like to ask my classes out loud, when do you think the body finishes insulating its wires? And a lot of students will say, well, it's done at birth, or there'll be other guesses. Well, most of it's completed by about 5 years of age. But we don't totally complete myelinating our axons until about, 26 to 30 years old. Which reminds me of some true and interesting things. Have you ever seen a little baby, a little kid? You know, you see them try to walk and run. Are they all coordinated? Well, of course not. Well, one of those reasons is because their wires aren't done yet. I mean, they haven't fully completed their wiring system, so they're not coordinated. I'm going to say something else that I like to say in my classes, and this is true, and I at least I feel it is. Some of you will be agreeing with me at home if you're around my age. You know, when we're teenagers, a lot of us kind of think we know everything. You know, we tell our parents that we know what's going on, and they don't possibly have any idea of what's happening, and we got it all right and they got it all wrong. And then, right about when I hit 26 years old. And I've had many students in my face-to-face classes nod their heads when I said this next thing. Right about when I hit 26 years old, it was like a light bulb came on. It was like all of a sudden I was figuring things out and processing things. And again, like a light bulb came out, and it really coincides with the time of completion of myelination. So think about that. I bet some of you at home are saying, yeah, you know, it was right about 26 where I realized, you know, the real deal. And when I was a teenager, I really didn't know what was happening as much as I thought. This reminds me of a true story. I tell jokes in my face-to-face classes. I got to leave most of those out here. But I will tell a couple of stories to give you sort of a mental break and time to write some notes down. My oldest daughter came to me when she was 21 years old. And she said she wanted to get married. And I sat down with her and I told her no. I said, no, you can't get married. And she said, well, why not? And I said, well, because your brain, it's not fully formed yet. You don't know what you're doing. Anyway, let's move on. Okay. How do we classify neurons? This is pretty simple stuff. We could classify neurons as to how they are shaped. That's called a structural classification. Or we can classify them on their function. That's called a functional classification. Let's do those one at a time in that order. First, the structural classification. The key here is, let's say on a testing situation, whether I describe a neuron or show you a picture of a neuron, look at the cell body. If there are more than two processes coming out of the cell body, we call that a multipolar neuron because there are multiple things coming out the cell body. And most neurons in the central nervous system are multipolar neurons. What about bipolar neurons? Well, let's look over here. Here's the cell body. How many things are coming out of the cell body total? One, two. We call that bipolar because bi means two. Where do you see those in the human body? And I want you to know this, so you're going to need to take notes. In general, we'll see these a lot in the eye, the ear, and the nose. Finally, here's another neuron. Look at the cell body. How many things are coming out of the cell body? Only one. The term for that is a unipolar neuron. Uni, like a unicycle, has one wheel. So a unipolar neuron just has one process extending from the cell body. Where do we find these in the human body? Write this one down somewhere in your notes. These are neurons that extend, for example, from your skin, let's say in your fingers and toes, all the way into a part of the body you'll study in lab, and we'll study later in this section, called the dorsal root ganglion. So write down, from skin to dorsal root ganglion. Then comes the functional classification of neurons, and it's easy. Sensory neurons, also called afferent neurons. Remember your term, afferent. Afferent means to carry towards. Sensory neurons carry sensory information from sensory receptors towards and into the central nervous system, meaning, of course, the brain and the spinal cord. Next comes interneurons. I love the term interneurons. Inter means in between. And if you look at the wording on the slide, that helps me with location, because interneurons are located in between sensory and motor neurons. Enter helps me one more time, because enter to me kind of sounds like integrative. And sure enough, the function of interneurons is to integrate. It's processing. These are mainly located in the central nervous system, in the brain and cord, and they are sandwiched between the sensory and motor neurons. It should not be surprising to you if I ask you on the test which neurons form the majority of neurons in the body. I hope you would pick interneurons. I mean, what do you think it takes more meat, more nervous tissue to do? Sense things, process things, or move things? And of course, processing is the most complicated function, so of course we need a whole mess of interneurons. 100 billion neurons just in the brain alone. Finally, motor neurons, also called efferent neurons. You remember, efferent means to carry away, and motor neurons carry motor information away from the central nervous system to the place we get the effect called the effector. We're going to end today's session by talking about the neuroglial cells. There are six different cells with six different names and six different functions, and yet we got to know them all because we're ANP2. This is just the intro organizational slide. We'll look at these cells one at a time in this order. But what I want you to do on this slide right now is draw a line in the sand right here, because all those four cells above my line, they are located, if I ask you, in the central nervous system. And the two cells below my line are in the peripheral nervous system. I set it up this way on purpose for my pea brain so I can remember this. Look, both cells in the peripheral system start with the letter S. And when I see S, I think side. And peripheral means off to the side. So the side cells are the S cells. Let's look at them one at a time in this order. Break this down. First cell, the astrocyte. I love that cell. You should see it in the lab. Cyte means cell. Astro means star-shaped. They are large and numerous star-shaped cells. Little figure off to your left here. Let me explain this. These astrocytes, with their processes, look what they're doing. They're grabbing on to pieces of the nerve cell. They're grabbing on to the capillary blood supply, and they're pulling them close together. What better way to take care of the Big Mac Daddy neuron than to pull it close to its blood supply? You remember ANP1, blood vessels, in with the good, out with the bad. So what a great cell. I love the astrocyte. So functions include support, protect, nourish, take care of. Specifically how? By helping maintain the proper chemical environment and helping maintain and regulate something very important with two stars around it called the blood-brain barrier of the brain capillaries. So let's talk about this cell. I like to think of this cell like the gatekeeper cell. Maybe write that off to the side here. Don't call it that on the test, but that's a good kind of way to start. This cell regulates what gets back and forth or not from the blood supply to the neuron. So, for example, let's say you're the CEO of a major drug company and you want to invent a new drug to treat brain cancer or brain infections and become a multi-bazillionaire. By the way, if you do, cut me in just 1%. That's all I'm asking. This is the cell you have to be able to bypass. It's tough to get drugs to the brain. Some brain cancers and some brain abscesses, in order to treat them, sometimes you have to jack the chemotherapy or the antibiotic right into the spinal fluid. So if you find a way to bypass it, you're going to help a lot of people. I'll give you another example how this gatekeeper cell works. Some drugs we take get past the gatekeeper when we don't want them to. Think of this. Last time you took a cold preparation for your cold, it also might have made you sleepy or dizzy or something like that. Well, that's not really the point of the drug. And many drug companies try and advertise that their cold pill won't make you drowsy. So, again, if you can learn how to manipulate the astrocyte, you will help a lot of people and you'll make a good chunk of change. The next cell in the central nervous system is the oligodendrocyte. Cyte means cell, dendro means branches, oligo means a few. So here's a cell with a few branches. It is located in the CNS. You should know that from the way I gave you the little tip and trick on the intro slide. Another way I remember it is I use this little O here and I kind of make a halo around my head. Whether that's appropriate or not, it doesn't matter. It just reminds me that that is a cell that's in my head. What does this cell do? This cell has the important job of producing myelin around axons. So here it is in the central nervous system slapping myelin on axons. I think of this cell as the Spider-Man cell. You guys know Spider-Man. He flips his wrists and these spider webs come out. But in this case, I picture myself as Spider-Man and I make myself really small and I stand inside the brain, and instead of slinging spider webs, I just sit there and I sling myelin on a whole bunch of axons. So that's just a little kind of pea brain technique that I use to remember this guy. It's the Spider-Man cell. But don't call it that on the test. Call it an oligodendrocyte. Next comes the microglial cell, called micro because it's small. Its purpose in the central nervous system is phagocytosis. In other words, it removes junk, debris, microbes that don't belong. It's the Pac-Man cell. So, you know, in layman's terms, you can write Pac-Man cell off to the side if that helps you to remember this cell. Let's stop here, take a little clinical break. I want to, just for fun, shouldn't use that term for fun, for interest sake, I want to talk about a disorder called Alzheimer's. Many of us have probably heard of that. If you've ever had to take care of a patient with Alzheimer's, it is one of the most challenging things physically, emotionally, psychologically that you will ever do. It's a disorder we're trying to find a cure for. There's not one yet as of the time of this recording, but there's a lot of people working on it. Alzheimer's, when we look at autopsies of their brains, they have an abnormal protein buildup. And I like to describe it like ivy, and the protein kind of grows like ivy and it kind of strangles off their neurons and kills their brain cells. Well, one potential theory, and I realize it's not a common theory, but I'm just trying to make a clinical correlation here. One theory is maybe these cells aren't doing their job. Maybe the Pac-Man cells aren't gobbling up that ivy, that bad protein. And I was able to Google microglial cells and Alzheimer's disease, and up came an article where somebody is actually trying to take the microglial cells and what they called supercharge them to get them all fired up and maybe use those supercharged microglial cells as a potential treatment for Alzheimer's. So, yes, this is real stuff and can have real application. So I know you're learning this stuff to get an A, but learn it because you want to help people. Next cell, called an ependymal cell. Epi, root word, means to line, and these are lining cells. They are located in two major places. Number one, they line the central canal of the spinal cord, which we already studied, and also, or you already saw that probably in lab, and also they line something called the choroid plexus. All the choroid plexus is are blood vessels, capillaries, that are located in ventricles in the brain. We're kind of ahead of ourselves, so let me try to explain that better. Let me jump to another slide, and we'll study this in more detail when we do the brain. This is sort of a transparent view of the brain. You're kind of looking into the brain with X-ray goggles, so to speak. And inside the brain are these sort of blue, I call them kind of water balloon structures. There are a total of four of them. And those are ventricles. They're chambers filled with brain water, cerebrospinal fluid. And ventricles are little wads of capillaries. They're called choroid plexus. And those capillaries are lined by cells called ependymal cells. So, to make a long story short, they're located in the spinal cord and in the brain. So, is this peripheral or central nervous system? I hope you answered it right. It's the brain, it's the cord, so it's central nervous system. What's their purpose? They form and secrete cerebrospinal fluid from the blood plasma. In other words, these cells, which are plastered on capillaries, will suck the plasma out of the blood. They'll perform their metabolic magic, and they'll drip drop a new fluid, now called cerebrospinal fluid, into the brain ventricles. Into the brain ventricles. Also note on these cells, there are cilia. Remember what cilia do? Cilia, they move, they beat. And when we get there, we'll see that cerebrospinal fluid does circulate, and the cilia will have some role, presumably, in helping that normal circulation of our brain water. The next neuroglial cell is called a satellite cell. And again, you may have seen these in lab already. Here they are in pink, surrounding the big mommy neuron cell body, sort of surrounding them like satellites surround the Earth, I guess, is a good example. They support, they protect, they take care of, they nourish the big mommy neuron. They surround neuron cell bodies in what are called ganglia. All the ganglia is a lump. We'll talk about these more in the future when we get to that PowerPoint, but you may have already seen that in lab. Ganglia, you will see them, for example, off to the sides of the spinal cord. They're called the dorsal root ganglia. They're lumps of neuron cell bodies hanging off and outside of the spinal cord. Therefore, this location that I'd want you to write down, dorsal root ganglion, since it's outside the spinal cord, hanging off the spinal cord, it is peripheral nervous system. You knew that already because it's an S cell. It has to be a side cell. It has to be a peripheral cell. The last neuroglial cell I'm going to make this one my favorite cell of the day now. I think I said the astrocyte was my favorite, but now this is my favorite. It's called the Schwann cell. You may also call it a Schwann cell. Both pronunciations are correct. And it just makes you sound real smart when you talk to mom and dad at home or you're taking A&P2. You want to be able to impress them. Yes, it's a side cell. It's in the peripheral system. Notice what the function is. It says can produce myelin around axon. Not always. It says can. So they usually do, most of the time they do, but they don't have to produce myelin. In the picture to your left, here is a Schwann cell. Here's the nucleus, here's the pink cytoplasm, and in this top figure, all the Schwann cell is doing is kind of grabbing onto and holding a bunch of axons. Down below, we see an axon in yellow, and it's surrounded by these little sausage-like things. And these are the Schwann cells that are slapping myelin down on that axon. Just for interest's sake, they slap it down about 1 millimeter at a time. It's not a continuous sheath of myelin. Notice there are gaps in between the cells, gaps in the myelin sheath called nodes of Ranvier. Yes, that's the correct way to say it because I took French in high school. It was 5 years of high school French. Anybody catch that? Yeah, and it was advanced placement French. You know, that's the course where you're supposed to take the course and at the end take the test and your parents are counting on you to pass that test so you get college credit to save some money. Well, here's a true story. While you're making notes, we'll take a little mental break here. I took the advanced placement test. I went in the test, and first I took the written portion, and I thought, I'm doing awesome. I'm going to get my college credit. Then comes the oral part of the examination, and I'll never forget it. This woman comes in with a tape recorder. Yeah, you guys might not know what that is, but she puts the tape in the tape recorder, closes it up, pushes the button and says, now begins the oral part of your examination. And this lady started talking in French, and I couldn't understand a word that was coming out of her mouth. And I had to stand up, and I said to the proctor, I said, I don't understand anything she's saying. I'm sorry. I punt. I give up. And, of course, I failed the test, and after 5 years of high school French, no college credit. Totally worthless, parents disappointed until now. Look, nodes of Ranvier, properly pronounced. So there you go. Next thing on this slide, another definition called a neurolemma. The breakdown root words means nerve sheath. In other words, for our studying pleasure, someone decided to give a name to the outer nucleated layer of the Schwann cell. So this part of the Schwann cell with the nucleus and the pink cytoplasm, that's called the neurolemma. Why do I throw that in there? Because you guys have enough to remember. Well, remember, these are glial cells. These can divide and multiply and become tumors. You will hear of tumors called schwannomas, or sometimes they call them neurolemmomas. So these are real terms you'll see in real life. This is a big picture. Again, we've seen this slide of the neuron. It's just cool to see the axon here with the Schwann cells kind of slapping on little jelly rolls of fat. It reminds me of in the butcher shop, you see the sausage links and the sausages are kind of all twisted together and then there's that little gap in between them. Of course, my analogy here is those gaps between the sausage links are the nodes of Ranvier and the sausages are mostly fat, so that would be the fatty myelin. I like this picture too. I'm not going to ask you to describe exactly the mechanics here, but you should know the basics. And the basics are this. Here's a Schwann cell, and here's its yellow cell membrane. Here it is surrounding an axon. And what it does, in summary, is it starts to wrap itself. It jelly rolls itself around the axon maybe 100 times. So it wraps its cell membrane around the axon, and that's how we form a myelin sheath. And that should make sense with kind of all we've said so far. What is myelin sheath? It's a fatty insulating sheath. What is the cell membrane? Well, that's AMP1. Does anybody remember phospholipid bilayer? Yep, that's how we slap on the fatty myelin sheath, by putting on rolls and rolls and rolls of a cell membrane. I love this slide. This slide is off the hook. Or as my son would say, this slide is sick. It is in color. It's 5,000 power transmission electron micrograph. It's the kind of thing I use as computer wallpaper or email to my friends. But my friends are kind of different. But let's break it down. This is cool. Here is the nucleus of a Schwann cell. Here is, in green now, the cytoplasm. So this part would be the neurolemma. Here is the cell membrane of the Schwann cell in brown, maybe wrapped 100 times around the blue axon. That is just too cool. Okay, so look, we covered the six neuroglial cells. You're saying, well, I'm AMP2. I can memorize, you know, what they are, where they are, and what they do. But how do I ask the question on the test? Because, you know, we're raising the bar here so you can go to the next level, so you can meet the challenges ahead, maybe in the health sciences, the nursing program, or wherever you're going next. On the test, here's how I like to ask the question. Let's say, for example, your patient has Lyme disease. And in the course of the Lyme disease, that infection led to demyelination of some axons in their brain. Which cell will try to replace the lost myelin? Aha. You got to think, don't you? First, you think, well, wait a minute, now which cells replace myelin? He just said Schwann cell, that's one of them. But the other one was the Spider-Man guy, the oligodendrocyte. So which one is it? Well, listen to the question. I stripped myelin in the brain. So which cell is the correct answer? It's the oligodendrocyte, because the oligodendrocyte does myelin, and it does it in the central nervous system, which would include, of course, the brain. I'll ask another question to see if you got it. Let's say your patient has received a vaccination, and post-vaccination they developed a demyelination syndrome, and they stripped the myelin got stripped off their sciatic nerve. Which cell is responsible for trying to replace the lost myelin? Correct answer would be Schwann cell. Why? Schwann cell does myelin, and where does it do it? Peripheral nervous system. And where is the sciatic nerve? That is, of course, peripheral nervous system. Our last slide for this session is titled Repair of Axons in the Peripheral Nervous System. If I were you, I would retitle this slide, you know, in English. In other words, how do we fix our wires if they break? Okay? Notice, let's start at the top. We're only talking about the peripheral nervous system. For the purposes of our course, if a nerve gets whacked in the central nervous system, it doesn't come back. Okay? So we're just talking about repair of wires in the peripheral nervous system. You need to know the conditions that must be present in order for this to successfully take place. Number one, we have to be talking about an axon that's myelinated. So if I take a knife, boom, cut through some axons in my arm, which of course would be peripheral nervous system, it would have to be a myelinated axon. Next condition, the neuron cell body has to be intact. In other words, you can't lop off the head of the snake and expect the tail to regenerate. Third bullet point on this slide. Some Schwann cells must be functional. In other words, the neurolemma, specifically the outer nucleated part of some Schwann cells, must still be living. Because what happens? This is key. The living Schwann cells on either side of that, I'm trying to find my pointer, there it is. The Schwann cells on either side of where I cut the wire, some of them have to be living, because what happens is they undergo garden variety mitosis and they grow together to form a tubular structure called a regeneration tube. This will allow, hopefully, the two ends of the cut wire to find each other and grow together and meet in the center of that regeneration tube. But that will happen if and only if scar tissue doesn't grow too rapidly, because if scar tissue grows into the gap where we just cut ourselves, if the scar tissue gets in there before the two cut ends of the wire meet, well, that axon probably is not going to be able to regenerate. And it takes time. I mean, you may have heard of friends or loved ones who've had surgery and they may feel numb in the region of the surgery. And sometimes the feeling never comes back, or sometimes it takes months or even a year to get sensation back in an area where we've cut across some wires. A clinical application of this, while you're making notes, just for fun, some very bright people have thought of a way to help this process. Some people have come up with an implantable collagen sheath. It's like a sleeve they manufactured out of protein, out of collagen. And they implant it into people with nerve injuries, and they take this sheath, they take the two ends of the cut axon, the cut nerve, and they put it inside the collagen sleeve, and therefore it allows the cut ends of that wire to find each other maybe better and faster, and of course prevents the problem of scar tissue growing in and blocking the process. So yeah, this is real stuff for real life.